So I will begin just by giving a brief overview of our discussion. The city represents more than just a collection of individuals living under the law of state. Urban centers promulgate an urban style of living. In fact, the distinctive characteristics of city life represent a unique culture, and some may say a normative universe, a nomos, and create unique demands on living spaces. The rise of cities and the particular demands marks the revolution of these cities becoming a source of law unto itself. The prevalence of the city demonstrates its strength as an institution that could create law that is then further recognized by the state. In our discussion, we'll look at city life becoming a source of informal law which promulgates a formation and regulation by state laws of city living practices. In particular, we will look at the phenomenon of undivided co-ownership, predominantly in Quebec. We'll look at three interrelated factors which propel the formation of the pre-existing norm of undivided co-ownership. First, we'll examine population growth and densities placing increased demands on housing in cities. The second factor we identify is the changing face of families in the city of having fewer children and its effects on building predilections of family dwellings. These two factors explain the preference of co-ownership of city property. Finally, the historical affordability of indivision is a third factor which can explain the appeal of undivided co-ownership of property in city centers. These factors pre-exist regulation of undivided co-ownership in civil law countries, which demonstrate the power of the city to establish strong norms that predate secular recognition of a fleshed-out regime of undivided co-ownership. The legislator did not create undivided co-ownership as a mode of ownership, rather the city did. So I discussed the city as a source of law, and it could be understood as a vehicle or context in which causal forces culminate to propel change. And when I talk of change, particularly Articles 1015 to 1023 on the rights and obligations of undivided co-owners, Articles 1025 to 1029 on the administration of undivided property, and finally 1030 to 37 on the end of indivision and partition. Robert Cover argues that rules and principles of justice, as well as the informal institutions of the law, conventions of social order, are but a small part of the normative universe which ought to claim our attention. In this world, law and narrative are inseparably related. So perhaps the way in which people choose to live, their lifestyle choices of dwellings, is a manifestation of this narrative. So maybe you could understand that normativity, expressed as whatever substance or form a law will take, is linked to the reality and the imagined alternative. So a discussion of co-ownership first calls for me to review the Roman conception of property and how it's unique in Quebec. So in Roman law, there's only one form of ownership, which is dominion. The right of ownership gives a person all the benefits that can be derived from an object of property. And in Quebec civil law property regime, this translates into Article 947, which gives the owner an ability to act fully and freely, distinguishing ownership from the rest of real rights. The civilian conception of ownership is opposable to all third parties and cannot be limited. However, it must be noted that the Romans did not explicitly define what is ownership. During the post-classical period, the Roman manifestation of ownership rights consisted and still does today of the powers known as usus, fructus, and abusus, so use, enjoyment, and disposition. And thus the owner in Article 947 has the fullest of real rights. Article 1009 of the CCQ specifies that ownership has special modes, one of which is co-ownership, which can be divided or undivided, undivided being the subject of this paper. Now, it can be understood that divided and undivided ownership are different than disbursements, since limited real rights are not being given by a bare owner to a titulary. However, divided and undivided co-ownership are different from each other in the sense that each co-owner has rights over the whole immovable or an object of property, which undivided co-owners purchase property. They all contribute to the sale price. Each has a share in the immovable. So no one owner has an exclusive portion of the property, rather they each own a fraction. As most of the discussion will concentrate on, the plex, so the duplex, the triplex, is the best example of this type of immovable subject to undivided co-ownership. This mode of ownership significantly contrasts to, for instance, the condo, which is a divided form of co-ownership. Here, the right of ownership is a portion among co-owners in fractions, each comprising of a divided by exclusive private portion and a share in the common portion. So we'll go over the changes in reform.
So with a basic understanding of what indivision is, we can go back and look at the first civil code, the Civil Code of Lower Canada. So that was about in the 1860s, and the important thing to realize is that in the first civil code, the Civil Code of Lower Canada, there was really only one provision on indivision. It was Article 689, it was a successions provision, and it read that no one can be compelled to remain in undivided ownership. A partition may always be demanded, notwithstanding any prohibition or agreement to the contrary. It may, however, be agreed or ordered that the partition shall be deferred during a limited time if there be any reason of utility which justifies the delay. We can sort of understand why there would be a limited notion of undivided ownership of property. During that time, Quebec was coming away from the 17th century of the seigneurial system, so they're making a concerted effort to move away from understandings of dual interest in property. So it was given a very limited view. And the Civil Code of Lower Canada just saw it as really a consequence of succession. You know, a mother owns a house, dies, leaves it to her three children. And so the three children, by a coincidence of successions, are now going to own this in undivided co-ownership. But what we've looked at is, given the over time, cities developing in Quebec, becoming more urban centers, we have a lot of migration, population density increases, the pressure for communal living was such that part of the common practice is that people were living together, and there was a push to have the legal regimes of ownership reflect that reality. So by the time the Civil Code was being reformed, discussions about the reform, the Civil Code Revision Office came about in the 1950s. The Civil Code Revision Office started looking at what are the common practices in Quebec. And so those are some of the factors that they were looking at that we'll address a little bit later, but just to let you know where the law stands now, under the Civil Code today, there is a comparatively highly regulated regime of undivided co-ownership. Tara threw out a bunch of article numbers. For those that are interested, sort of the basic provision we started in 1012 of the CCQ to say, how is indivision created? Rather than just being limited to a consequence of succession, we say it can be created by contract, also succession, or any other operation of law. So that gives a much broader understanding to how indivision is actually formed. There are a number of articles governing the regulation of fruits and revenues from undivided property that was just never discussed under the Civil Code of Lower Canada. And then even to facilitate further ownership, there are several provisions on hypothèques and debts that attach, because one of the complications with undivided property to this day is that it's very difficult to finance, because you're not actually owning the property, you're owning an interest in the property. So if a bank wants to give you an hypothèque, they can't actually secure it on the property because you don't own the actual immovable. But to facilitate that, the Civil Code developed a couple of provisions to allow for these debts to still attach to the property even though you don't own it directly. So that's sort of the status of the law as it stands. And now I think we'll move on to some of the main factors that we identify.
Right, so I'm just going to discuss a couple of statistics, and we see that with changes in population, the family dynamics in the home, this occurred at a time while there was changes going on in the revision office. So there's obviously, our intuitions are that there's an obvious connection there. So post-war Quebec experienced an unprecedented growth and urbanization. Although Quebec does have a long history of densely populated cities, the density increased from 61.2% in 1941 to 74.3% in 1961. French-Canadian birth rates remained high following the war, with it not uncommon for families to have 7 or 8 members. The end of the war also brought with it expected baby boom effect, further accounting for a surge in population growth. On the opposite end of the spectrum, what with the wars and improvements in both medicine and the Quebec healthcare system, the death rate significantly decreased. As a result, in the 20-year period from 1941 to 1961, the population of Montreal increased by almost 1 million. By 1961, 40% of Quebec's population was located in Montreal. And the population of the suburbs steadily increased. Many Quebec suburbs grew into towns and cities. The number of towns and cities increased from 139 in 1941 to 227 by 1960. In neighboring Quebec City, although population growth was not as pronounced as in Montreal, it was nevertheless steady. Quebec City population increased from 14% from 1951 to 1961. Not only was population increasing, but this also led to housing being a constant problem in the cities. And as the cities were becoming more and more crowded, it really challenged finding new ways of accommodating these new people. So I will just skip this. With increases in the population, naturally came demands for more housing all over the province. Population had a direct effect on the need to find solutions, and co-ownership provided the potential for accommodating the housing needs to a greater percentage of Quebec population. As the population grew, construction began to respond to housing needs by designing dwellings for more efficient use of city space. It was therefore during this era that high-rises and multifamily dwellings became popular. These architectural realities presented the growing Quebec populace with co-ownership solutions to the problems of housing in cities. By living in co-ownership, people in Quebec could remain in the cities and still be homeowners. So there was also this willingness to be a homeowner, to actually own property. So as population was growing, and not only was there a problem with finding housing, people wanted to actually own something. So as I alluded to before, where do we find the most common form of undivided co-ownership is the duplex, the triplex, the fourplex, the sixplex. Which was the most common form by 1966, which made up 50% of the dwellings in the city of Montreal. When we say housing affordability, it ties to the high density of housing, an effort not to waste any space so that land can be used more efficiently. In such a context, building materials costs can be relatively cheaper and heating and energy costs can be lowered. And it is this housing design which functions hand-in-hand with the undivided form of co-ownership, which has resulted from the economic advantages tied to high-density development, which will make housing more accessible to low- and income families, first-time owners. And while it is usually associated with smaller spaces, it could be more efficiently planned. In addition to increasing population, the need for more efficiently planned units ties to changes in the family structure and the desire to find practicality in converting spaces as opposed to frequently enduring moving costs in purchasing and selling property more often. In the earlier part of the 19th century, the norm was one family dwellings, which were spatially wider than they were deep, with the traditional mode of ownership beginning with full ownership, not divided. Architects and construction experts in their work, we can identify a self-conscious effort to accommodate their designs to the special needs and desires of the new family structure. Which brings us to the second factor, being social demographics and family structure. The marriage rates across Canada plummeted over the last century, whereas in the 1940s, there were roughly 10.9 marriages for every 1,000 people. By 2000, there were only 4.7 per every 1,000 people. At this time, home ownership rates across Canada were rising. We may conclude that marriage or not, people are still purchasing homes. Furthermore, Quebec couples were married or not, they wanted to purchase residence in high numbers. So the social phenomenon, increased numbers of common law partners and decreased rates of marriages in Quebec, does not mean that the partners didn't want to seek to share their assets. So even though we see there's a decline in the institution of marriage, people still wanted to buy property together. The legislators in the new code addressed this insufficiency of the law. So the law was seen as being insufficient to adapt to this new trend and this new demand. So as Marie Deschamps writes, les juristes québécois semblent avoir pris conscience de l'évolution des mentalités et des changements dans la situation économique. Les dispositions du projet du Code civil et du projet 58 en sont la marque. So we have an explicit reference here that the legislator wanted to respond to this. So there's a direct motivation. I was going to go over to the different changes in the dynamics. There's very briefly, because I want to let my colleagues speak. There were fewer children living at home. So there's therefore less need to have bedrooms. And so the duplex as a form of co-ownership also allowed the space to be easily convertible. So people are becoming more creative with the spaces as well. So I will move forward.
Sure. The third factor that we looked at was the affordability of undivided co-ownership. The principle of co-ownership in general is that you're sharing costs. And this is not limited just to the city context. In fact, the rise of indivision in France was largely promulgated by the fact that French farmers couldn't afford land, and so they would come together in groups and divide and purchase it together. But the basic idea is that when you divide up the property, it's going to be cheaper. The other reality, given the financing difficulties, people who tend to own something in indivision, they tend to be in smaller numbers, and that fosters this sort of communitarian spirit, so where people chip in and they lower the maintenance fees. You don't need to go and hire a separate condo management company to handle your duplex. It's you and whoever the family may be living above you, and you work out and administrate costs as efficiently as you can. And then the important role of the state here is that historically, evaluations on undivided properties have been lower. So after you partition, say if you take a duplex and you were able to divide up the heating system and the electricity, et cetera, and you would actually divide it so it's no longer in indivision that you own it, but two separate properties completely owned by two separate families, the municipal evaluations go up, the taxes go up. So it's much cheaper to own something in division, and part of that is the state they're going to be taxing less properties that are exchanging hands less frequently. So given that's the case, properties that have been held in division, it's been much cheaper overall to purchase them and maintain them. And that's been an important factor in increasing access to housing amidst the growing housing demands in cities. So, I mean, we're just going to draw it to a conclusion here. We think that it's been interesting to look at the cities and their important effect in really transforming property law, because these are unique demands that arose to cities in Quebec. And the effect of these growing demands for housing, the growing population, and the need for affordable housing is that they have led to this property law reform that affects the entire province. There's a mode of ownership that is now available to people out in the suburbs and way beyond, to farmers, even though that was not a need that affected them. So we really see the role of the city at the forefront of pushing property law.
And also, the case law reveals that there was this bias against indivision. Judges did not like ruling, on indivision and letting this mode of ownership, basically stay the way that it was. There had to eventually be partition. And so it shows that the city and whatever factors that we've identified had an effect on the law rather than the reverse.
Thank you. I just want to have some precision about what is it that you're trying to track? Are you trying to track the justifications of the cities to implement these kind of property laws? The kind of justifications they use? They say cities will use the justification of we're doing this in order to answer motivations that people have to be homeowners. Or because there's a different stories that can be told also, because in the beginning of the 70s, public programs for the construction of rental apartments were abandoned. And also all the public housing was stopped to almost a halt. So the public policies kind of downloaded the all the financing problems of building houses and apartments to private persons, to real estate developers, et cetera, which is good if you're just managing money. You think, oh, this is going to cost us a lot less. And then you say, well, people, they want to be homeowners. For example, and I'm not sure it's really efficient to have a lot of homeowners. For instance, in Sweden, 70% of the population lives in public housing. And almost all of the park of public housing is very energy efficient. There's geothermal, something we don't have here. So it could be that public housing is more efficient. It could be that it costs less to the collectivity to have public housing. It could be that individuals will be more in a densified neighborhood than sprawled over, because real estate developers will always try to go where taxes are better, et cetera. And another thing is that there's a lot of conflict of interest in municipal agents to develop, to transform duplexes and triplexes in condos, because then you have a better tax base. So they have a lot of conflict of interest there to privatize housing on the and the people that were renting in these duplexes and triplexes are just displaced elsewhere. So I see that as a justification of the law, saying we're doing this in order to answer that kind of thing, and not much an answer to a problem, because there are different other answers that could be better to this problem.
For sure. We did not discuss particularly the justifications for this form of ownership. But it's interesting that you bring up the construction statistics, because that was part of our paper. Unfortunately, we weren't able to address it. But construction companies had to ignore the public. Initially, the city, the municipality wanted to fund single family dwellings, and the construction companies had to ignore it because that's not what people wanted. And it's not necessarily about wanting to become more homeowners, more people wanting to become homeowners. It was finding more creative ways to make it affordable, because not everyone could afford to be homeowners. But again, it's the fact that people were really already living this way. It was a norm, and so the law had to adapt. It doesn't necessarily mean that it was the best solution. As you've given, you know, a comparative perspective, there are other solutions, but this is the observations and the parallels that we've drawn.
Wanted to add, coming at it from a bit of a legal perspective, what we see when Tara refers to this was the norm, this is what was going on, we see tremendous number of cases over disputes over property that was owned in division before it was recognized in the civil code in the fully fledged way that it is now. And so the civil code revision office explicitly references the common practice as one of the reasons why they had to flesh out this regime, because people were already living that way and they were already creating disputes. So instead of coming back to the court every single time, so Mr. X and Madam Y have a dispute over their property, they have a regime that preempts a lot of those disputes. And the number of disputes that, we see less frequently, it's difficult to track all of them, but the same issues are not reoccurring after now the new code that has been having these indivision provisions in it.
But definitely the justification aspect, it would be really interesting to study.
Looking at the dates when this is going on, there's something very interesting that's happening at the same time, and it's that as there's a move towards the broader recognition of indivision, which, as you've mentioned, and as in the case of the judges were simply articulating a general bias in code-based civil law countries, that the code abhors community. If there is some sort of community, whether it's successoral community or any other the post-divorce and yet still post-marital community of goods, the code will attempt to dissolve it at any possible with any possible excuse. So at the same time, there is a shift towards overcoming that bias in the code. And at the same time, Quebec is developing one of the most advanced condominium laws in the world, one that's become a model for American jurisdictions, for the jurisdiction where I studied law. The Puerto Rican condominium law, under which probably 80% of the people in Puerto Rico live, is effectively a translation with some editions of the Quebec law. The Quebec law was the explicit model for it. So you've mentioned the question of costs, of individuals, of market pressures, of individuals wanting to acquire housing and own housing at a lower cost given the dearth of alternatives in terms of public housing, et cetera, but still within the available market alternatives, preferring that to, say, a condominium arrangement. But those of us who are thinking of buying now and trying to get around the tax bienvenue, for instance, will notice that it's not that while there may have been private initiative in fostering or pushing in this direction, now there's something of an acquiescence that seems again to run counter to some of these of what ought to be the interests of the state. For example, the tax bienvenue is waived if you buy a certain property of more than one unit, but as long as you keep it in division for at least a year, if you convert it to condominium, then you lose the credit. And there's something in your paper that I think is unarticulated in the presentation that may account for this shift, and I'm wondering how much weight you give to it. And it's an ideological change. That is an ideological change that would explain perhaps the shift from the priorities of the code that every other civil law jurisdiction seems to have towards a more welcoming attitude towards this kind of community or non-formalized community, and perhaps a desire on the part of municipalities to foster these more informal quasi-communal arrangements as opposed to the very formal, very structured, almost quasi-constitutional structures of a condominium. So I wonder about that factor, in addition to the economic and social, et cetera, but the ideological factor that may have been at play.
It's very interesting that you bring that up, because I know that having had, for example, Professor Lametti for civil law property, there's definitely different attitudes towards private property, less being, individualist, rights-based, more communitarian. And it's not just these provisions, it's throughout, I can't tell you exactly specifically, but it's a constant theme throughout the 1933 Civil Code. So I agree, but
yeah,
in terms of...
I think that you do notice a significant ideological shift at the time. Again, you have to compare it to the 1866 CCLC, where everything is very strictly rights-based, individuals, power to the individual, moving away from colonization. By the time you get to the new civil code, we have a recognition of these different community structures. I think it's at a point where people are sort of regrouping and acknowledging the realities. And again, this is sort of the role of the city, the pressures of city life, and the importance of communitarian efforts. And so I think there really is an ideological shift that goes along with it, which is interesting because I think in some ways it goes a little bit counter to some of the developments in, say, family law, where you see like the women's liberation movement and the push for people to maintain their maiden names, don't take your husband's name. So I think it depends on the context, but certainly in anything that relates to the property side of things, we start to see more of an acknowledgement for the community efforts, the formation of something new, rather than the division into rather individualized conception of rights.
Thank you very much. It's really interesting to hear this case because I'm looking now into, I do quite a bit on housing that is, obviously housing choice and satisfaction, and I work with the city on some of their housing policy initiatives, which are incentives to homeownership, et cetera. My question is, do you think that this was not, it is very congruent with the previous question. There was an ideological shift here. Do you think that it was, you didn't, I realize this is not what your focus was, but I'm always curious about what motivates these kinds of shifts societally, et cetera. Do you think that it was Quebec just sort of, I don't want to say catching up, but saying, oh, we'd better do something to bring our society and our law mechanisms more in line with the norms in the Anglo-American world? Because I see this as very much an effort on the part of the state to encourage homeownership as something that is ideologically good. And there's a lot of work that's being done by people like David Luria and Mark Shoko on, that homeownership was, you could say, they don't say this, but a caricature of it for the sake of discussion, is that it was a kind of conspiracy theory to sort of quell labor unrest. If people are owner occupiers, then they'll be more busy making sure that their asset is in good shape rather than going down to the pub to plan a revolution or something like that. Because no, and quite literally, and there, you know, there's work that's been done digging up. I have a great ad: kill Bolshevism by erecting houses. You know, the Dominion Housing Act encouraged Yes. Kill Bolshevism. I'll circulate it. It's great. it was geared toward factory owners. but that homeownership had to be constructed as something that was good. And I think it's especially true in Quebec, where, you know, things worked really well. People were renting, and, you know, Sweden, Switzerland, over, I think it's more like 85 or 90% of the population is still renting. So I'm just curious if you found any evidence, or if you just want to speculate on to what extent was this maybe more of a, well, we better make our whatever it is, our civil code or our societal norms more congruent with everything, if only because there's federal money, there are subsidies for mortgages that the people, that households can benefit from, but only if they have access to home ownership.
I'm going to pick up on the theme that you just spoke about in terms of this bias on the homeowner, the person who's taking care of the object of property. There's definitely, you know, a preference for that in the code. If you see the articles on possession, and this theme even goes back to Roman law, but is seen more explicitly in the 1993 Civil Code, where if someone's a bona fide possessor, so they're not actually the owner of property. So the classic example is you have a plot of land, you cut the land in half, and one person who owns part of the land accidentally is living on the other side of the line. So they don't own that part of the line, but they're acting as a bona fide possessor. So as if they're living, going about as if it was their land. Well, the law says that after, you know, a couple of years, you're entitled to that land. And so conceptually, you know, theoretically, we could understand that they are taking care of the object of property. So I think that you're right, that there's definitely that attitude.
I think I would add that if we look at condos, I think some of that, and the improvements in the law, I think that's an effort to catch up. Particularly if you compare it to cities like New York. I mean, New York has got a very, very stable regime for, like, New York-style co-ops and things like that. So I think in that respect, it's a game of catch-up. But I think, we were looking particularly at undivided properties, and I think that's really an effort to just catch up with what actually was going on and make the legal reality reflect the actual reality on the ground.
The catching up is not a normatively good thing. I wanted that to be clear.
Je me demandais si votre conclusion, à savoir que Montréal voulait la conversion en condo et en a bénéficié, prend en compte le fait qu'il y a un moratoire qui a été vite imposé sur la conversion et qui fait partie de la façon de concevoir le rôle du condominium à Montréal. Donc, ce moratoire qui... Effectivement, on n'en a pas besoin dans certains arrondissements ou dans certaines villes reconstituées, comme on sait. Mais il me semble que c'est un élément significatif à prendre en considération pour en faire l'analyse globale. Je ne sais pas si vous n'en avez pas parlé. Évidemment, il y a eu des discussions à savoir de qui relevait ce pouvoir-là suite à la réforme et la création des arrondissements, villes reconstituées, tout ça. Mais bref, voici un élément juridique important, je pense, à ajouter à votre équation.
Je pense que vous avez totalement raison, que je pense que c'est un élément qu'on peut regarder pour que notre papier, so that it sort of grows. But I have nothing to, we didn't study the condo explicitly, but it would be really interesting to have a comparative aspect to that. I don't know.
At the same time, I would like to point out that I still think that there is a heavy emphasis in the code to prefer condos. You can divide, you can request partition at any time. If the property is deemed to be unavailable, you can't actually partition it. So the heating systems, again, electricity, all of that, it's too integrated, then you force a judicial sale of it. And that's sort of how we deal with that problem. And I think, I think we still really see that preference, but at the same time, I think it's important to note that there is this alternative regime of undivided co-ownership that has now been fleshed out, And that really, I mean, our, what we've looked at in our research is that's been a response to changes within the city, in and city living in particular.
But the condo is definitely an interesting point to continue our research.
So great. So the way I sort of read your paper was as kind of a response to change. Well, the way I heard your paper, I haven't actually read it. It was as a kind of response to changes on the ground. And you, in the course of your presentation and through some of the questions, you've talked about sort of tracking justifications, justificatory theories around property, right? So I wonder if it's possible, as just this is as a suggestion, to extend both the institution and the theory. So extending the communal aspect of the theory, right, beyond the communal, the people who own, who are involved in co-ownership, to the benefits that go to the community at large. And the way to think about this is to think about how to you might change the institution of property to achieve these kinds of benefits, right? So Peggy Cohen has, in her paper, talks about gentrification. And I think one way in which you can combat gentrification is to impose limits on alienation, right? So you can limit the price at which the owners can sell, right? And the idea here is that, and this is a property form used in the United States, the limited equity co-op. And the benefits of this go to the community in general, right? That is, so people are now more embedded in their community. People are more invested in their community. They're not chased out of their dwellings, right? So it reduces the possibility of gentrification, right? And it also reduces the risk of downward spirals, right? So in a lot of property regimes where you don't have these kinds of investments of owners in the property, right? There's absent slumlords, absent landowners, and you have sort of spiraling neighborhoods that spiral downwards, right? So I wonder, as sort of moving the paper forward idea, right, that is taking the argument, extending it both in its normative justification, right, extending the idea of community beyond the owners and extending the institutional form.
I think it's a great suggestion. Prof. Gong, thanks. We will definitely think about it.
I'm Rich Schrager. I'm a law professor at the University of Virginia, and I just taught co-ownership this semester. So what's stunning to me, and maybe you could help me with this question of translation, is, let me get my notes back. Thank you. Sorry about that. Thank you. Is that, and maybe I'm misunderstanding you, but there was not until the 30s a concept of co-ownership in Quebec. That is that you own the whole. That is two. So in the common law, my understanding is that we've had undivided co-ownership forever, not forever, but so tenants in common, joint tenancy, tenancy by the entires, and those things didn't exist. Got it. Okay.
Reference to it in the succession chapter.
Right.
It was happening. People would buy things together, but there was no way to really regulate people's interests when things go wrong.
Okay. So my question is the following, which is, if the common law form, the story you're telling is an urbanization story, which forces this, but the common law forms presumably didn't develop out of urbanization, though I guess we could check to see if that were the case. They're older. So you might want to think about why does it develop so late in the civil code and much earlier certainly in the common law, and then and that might point you to a different rationale or reason or account. And then the second thing I would ask is to what extent the city actually has power over this law. So one of the characteristics of common law property in the United States is it's regional, that is it's state based, and there is a private law exception to cities doing anything to regulate property. It sounds like that's the case here too. So maybe the cities were the impetus, but the law is coming from above. Is there any instances where the city itself creates a property law that's distinct from what the province would have?
I mean, Quebec lays down a property regime here, and you can derogate from some provisions of it. Most notably, like, cities can influence things by having municipal taxes. So Professor Munoz-Fraticelli referred to the bienvenue tax, which can push you into one mode of ownership or another, depending on how much money you have to spend on the immovable that you're buying. But the basic modes of ownership are laid down by the province, and you can't derogate from those.
And I know Professor Hoi Kong will be discussing, I think, in detail on the municipal law.
And then with regard to your first question, one of the things that Tara and I have been discussing throughout all of this, Tara's our resident McGill expert on Roman law and property, so I've been making her explain this to me lots, is that in the civilian concept, we really struggle with this notion of the foundations of absolute ownership of property. So you see not just in cases of indivision, but throughout property law discourse, very early on, the tensions of what are the limits of, if you absolutely own your property, what are the reasonable limits on that? So, you know, we get into questions of nuisance to neighbors, things like that. And then sort of the more developed version of that would be the dual interests or, you know, multiple interests in a property. But it really struggles with the foundational concepts of property as absolute ownership over it. In the civil law, which I think is something that, Virginia is my home state, so we don't really have that problem in the common law. Property law is what we decide it is. We can make it work. Whereas I find that there's a much more ideological concentration in civil law property.
So I know, for example, even in my civil law property class, we talk about common law conceptions of property and how they, you know, we talk about Tony Honoré and how it's totally different. And it's this ongoing debate, who has a better conception, you know, of property. So definitely it would be interesting to use that debate and our findings to maybe take a position.
I think it also, just to add one final comment, it goes back to the civilian predilection for creating a coherency in a property law form, whereas in the common law we're quite happy to just find a solution that works to the problem at hand. In the civil code, we're really trying to come up with a coherent regime that sticks to our notions of property law.
I'll allow Peggy a very quick question if she's promised to be very quick and if the respondents will also.
I'm getting ready.
There, because it's a little bit beyond the scope of your paper, but since she said you're an expert, I'm going to indulge myself.
I took one class.
Okay, so I was, and it's just a question of clarification. Okay. I was under the impression that Roman law actually had a very rich theorization of different modes of property ownership. So I thought the term res publica came from the idea of public property being public things, and that there was also res nullius and res universitatis. And res universitatis was the basis of a kind of collective, indivisible mode of property ownership in Roman law. And I was wondering if that was a misconception on my part, or if that contributed in any way to thinking about property that's not simply private property, individual, divisible private property.
You were talking about private property, right? I was talking about private property. There's definitely public forms of property. I know that it did. You were right. I'm sorry if that gave you the wrong impression. That it does have a rich Roman law did have a rich conception of different forms of ownership. So, for example, in the Book of Successions, there's explicit mention to the functional equivalent of the usufruct in terms of forms of public property. I didn't study that in detail, so I would love to have a discussion with you later about it.
My understanding, though, is the different categories you're talking about are really dependent on the form of property. So you're looking at, is this something that's going to be a public good? Like, what is inherent to that nature that's going to make this good one that would be subject to public ownership? Versus Tara was focusing on the Roman concepts of ownership of private property. So what are the different modes within that slice of the pie?
Thank you very much.